Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
So maybe I can do a very quick straw poll. How many people in this room are familiar with Lunig's work?
Whoa.
Well, there you are. We have critical mass. How critical, we shall see. But we have mass, which is great. So some of you may or may know, may not know where Michael comes from and what he does. So let's begin at the beginning, shall we? Where did you grow up and what was that like?
I grew up in Melbourne, essentially. I was born in Melbourne. I grew up in a very working class, what we used to call a working class suburb, lots of factories and labourers and workers. Yeah, very down-to-earth place. Not a pretty place, but, you know, that was where I started.
Did you draw as a kid? Were you a compulsive drawer, or is that something that emerged?
Not compulsive. I drew in the manner that most children can draw and enjoy to draw. There wasn't so much paper and pens around in those days. This is just after the war had finished. There was not much about. So there was a bit of drawing on the footpath. That's when you could find the footpath, with a bit of chalk and that sort of thing. But I enjoyed drawing.
What sort of thing? Did you doodle? Did you draw things outside you, or was it from your imagination?
It's like the way children draw is so still the most beautiful thing, I find. And I'm always entranced with children's drawings, and to watch the eagerness and the natural fluidity and enjoyment they have. You know, it's the best way to make a picture if you're just loving it and mucking about. So, but then there was so many stories of the war. We're talking the late 1940s, 1950s. There were a lot of war stories around. And so you would learn how to draw airplanes and bombs and all these sorts of things that children in Vietnam learned to draw. If anyone's ever visited the War Museum in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, there's a massive room full of children's drawings depicting what they call the American War. Very touching, very beautiful, very sad drawings.
Were you looking at other people's drawings at that time, or was that not available to you?
Oh, everything you see, you want to draw. Like you see a book. I grew up on Enid Blyton books and/or illustrations. My first book I ever read was called Shadow the Sheepdog. So, and Shadow the Sheepdog would have been sort of native to this sort of country here. So it's quite interesting for me to be walking through this landscape. And these are the images of childhood. Copy a dog and in those days children were encouraged quickly to get it right, to draw proper and to make it look like a photograph or something. And so there's a bit anal, really. It was all very too careful. Well, it didn't start like that, but it got like that when you went to school. And but then you have to recover that old way of drawing again. It's a lifetime's work to get back there again.
Did it ever occur to you that you might be sitting here talking about your work as something that you've made money from, that you've made a living from? Did you ever think you might be a professional, if that was such a thing?
No, I didn't. But there's this old idea that the only way out of the working class, out of the poverty trap, was either sport or art. And I was not so good at school. I enjoyed my school. I enjoyed my friends, my teachers. But for some reason, I didn't take it seriously. And I had my own learning to do. I was too interested in looking out the window as you probably see me doing here, seeing all these people going by. And so I didn't do well, and I realized as my friends went on to university and I didn't, and I was a bit sad about that. So you have to keep the wolf from the door, and that's a very real reason to want to find a way, you know, to survive. And some drawings emerged, and then there was something that came into my life, was the Vietnam War, which was a big deal in Australia at the time, in the 60s, and I was in the generation to be conscripted into the army, and my number came up, and I was due to for the army, and I was bitterly opposed to that war. I'd been following the course of it, the politics of it. Australia was tied to the American agenda, which was seemed terribly wrong to me. So I was determined I was not going into that war and into that army, and I was ready for jail because my case as a conscientious objector would not hold water. It was a very severe kind of definition of what a conscientious objector would be. For instance, there would be a hypothetical question in the court. So your grandmother is being beaten up by a gang of hoodlums that have broken into her house. What would you do? Yeah. And you say, oh, well, I just sit there and watch them. And then you're conscientious objector because you're a pacifist. But I knew I couldn't do that. So I was due for jail. I went in for my medical examination, and I'd been fighting. I'd been caught up in the anti-Vietnam War protest movement, which was very, very intense, and a lot of police confrontations, etc. And the doctor discovered something I'd forgotten, that I was born totally deaf in my right ear. So my fight was over. The wind was taken out of my sails. And I walked out of that place with my tail between my legs. But I continued on, and that protest movement, that awareness movement became very big. And I started drawing for little, what we called underground magazines. They were little sort of amateur protest things. And I started doing that, and one thing leads to another, as it does with a musician. They sing a little song somewhere, and someone likes it and asks them to sing another one there. And so it builds and builds. And then eventually a newspaper editor takes a risk and says, will you work for us and make cartoons? And I had no art training or anything like that. I was just a bravado and a kind of strong feelings.
So you started off actually as a political cartoonist. Is that what you were recognised as?
Yes, a political cartoonist, and that is a particular role. It exists there to comment on politics, to be, as someone said to me at the time, you must be the voice of the permanent opposition. Mm-hmm. So it was a way of looking at what was happening in the parliament, looking at politicians, you know, and to sort of put them under scrutiny. But very soon I started to discover that it's all very well to point to the politicians, as we must, and question them and hold them to account. But I became more interested in the extent, in what is our part in all of this. What it's easy to point to the politician, but what is our part in this? That thing, you know, for every finger you point, there are three pointing back at you. And so then that led me to, you know, what are we on about? What is human nature? And to what extent is the world going mad? You know, what is sanity? What is a healthy society? So these are very big questions. And so I was letting down the tradition of political cartooning, which is sort of debunking things and being scathing and clever, the cult of cleverness. and I was interested in opening it up, not nailing it, as people say. Mm-hmm. They sometimes say, oh, that's a great cartoon, you nailed it. And I thought, I don't want to nail it. I want to pull the nails out and open it up and put it back on us. What are we doing? Or, and so you go into psychoanalytic level. What's deep inside people? And what is our hypocrisy, et cetera, et cetera?
So
big questions.
So your cartoons, in a way, began to be really different. Did the paper have a problem with that?
They were bewildered a little, the editors were, but something they liked about it, they must have. I don't know how I survived. Like I would draw a cartoon about a political situation and put a little duck in the corner watching on, for instance. And an editor would say, well, one editor said to me one morning, just as I handed in my work on deadline, he said, I don't understand this. And I said, well, I don't really neither. But and then he said, but I like it. And that was a very important moment, that you don't have to fully understand. It doesn't have to, one and one equals two. That doesn't always have to work. There's a mystery one can create, which is what a poet does. There's a poetic element possible. And if you're drawing, you're in a primal level. It's symbols and little primal drawings which bypass the brain or the critical mind. And if you draw a funny face on a dog, it evokes an odd feeling, say, in a political context. Or it's hard to explain in words because you have to see it, I guess.
Yeah, I wish we had some pictures to show, but...
But yeah, and so I gave up trying to draw caricatures because I kind of thought that was cruel. Yeah, draw a caricature of someone, but that doesn't prove a thing. Wit is not necessarily wisdom, I discovered, and, you know. To draw, I started drawing an every person, should I say, in profile, a rather stupid-looking person too. So it was like a child, drawing a child, an innocent. And I realised this was really in the tradition of the court jester or the holy fool, you know, the voice, the child who says the emperor's got new clothes, it's got no clothes. And it wasn't just the emperor who doesn't have clothes, it's us who are hiding our nakedness, if you see what I mean. So that just became very interesting to me, that what are we made of? What are we on about? Why? What are we doing here on this earth, in this life? See, so these are big philosophical questions, and newspapers are not really concerned about that too much. They don't want that. That's too complicated. But it's fun. It's fun. And therein lies a lot of humour and a lot of mystery. And I sense that readers of newspapers were quite capable of handling these evocative mysteries, just light-hearted little moments, little Zen sort of poems, I suppose, that spirit of Zen, perhaps. Hmm.
But some of these characters have names and locations, like Mr. Curly in Curly Flat and his sort of disciple, the wonderfully named Vasco Pajama.
Yes.
Tell us about them.
Well, sometimes... It's like the creative impulse is sometimes trying to create something to fill a gap that you perceive in your society and your culture. You're trying to put something into it that you feel is missing. And I think every artist is sort of more or less doing that. It's an offering. I think the best art is offering something, and so I created these little characters, these two. Well, I didn't create them. They emerged off the tip of my pen, as things simply do. I play when I draw, and I imagine, like a child imagines, It's not a very clever process. It's a very regressive process. It's going down. It's becoming. It's going backwards. Mm-hmm. It's not going high and clever. It's going down and sort of playful. So Mr. Curly appears while I'm fiddling about with my pen, because so many things are found when the hand moves, when the hand is involved. You see, it's a physical process too. And so it's like children draw. They invent. And so I invented this little fellow, probably in a moment of desperation when I had no ideas. And then I put a little curl that went round and round on his head, and then this became Mr. Curly. And Mr. Curly was very a bit depressed about this peculiarity. And, in fact, it was a very symbol of peculiarity. And he was sort of upset about it. Why can't I be like everybody else, was his feeling. But then he started to notice that the world is full of things that curl. You know, the way a fern unfolds or a dog's tail curls, or plants, flowers, a vine is creeping up, it has tendrils that curl. And so he became happier. He realized he was part of nature. He wasn't a normal person, and who would want to be a normal person? He wanted to be part of nature, and he was. So he had a little friend, probably a young boy, probably a representation of his childhood. So Mr. Curly stays at home in Curly Flat and has a lovely bucolic life. Vasco wanders into the world and tries to circumnavigate his own world, or something like that. It's sort of nonsense, but it's fun. And so those series were a correspondence between the two. The young boy Vasco would ask Curly for some advice. Curly would offer it to the young boy, but the young boy would be finding astonishing, beautiful, disturbing things. So it was a way to address life itself.
Are they you?
Well, probably to some extent, but they're everybody, because I believe that what is most personal is most universal, and the more personal, like truly personal, you can become, it's not indulgent. Mm. If it's honest and if it's devout, then you find all of humanity within yourself to some extent. So there's no problem doing a very personal thing. And people would say, oh, you're making yourself vulnerable. You're owning up to all these feelings, insecurities, failures. I was saying, yes, everybody has them, and they love to see them spoken of. It's liberating. Mm. And I think that's what the poets and the songwriters do. It's an ancient tradition.
Tell us a little bit about what you do when the painting goes wrong or a drawing goes wrong.
What goes wrong
when a painting goes wrong, or a cartoon isn't working?
Yes, well, that is a very good thing to talk about. See, people say, "Where do you get ideas from?" And I say, my answer is, well, ideas turn up if you love ideas, if you enjoy ideas, they turn up. But if I wake up in the morning, I've got a deadline that day, and suddenly I've got a brainwave, a thing in my head, in my intellect, an idea, and I think, terrific, this is going to be great, easy day, I'll just go and draw it on the paper. And then, so I do that, I draw it, I transcribe it from my mind onto the paper, and it doesn't work, invariably. It doesn't work, because what works up here doesn't work there always, or rarely, really. So then what do you do? You're on a deadline. There's a newspaper waiting to go to press. There's a clock ticking. There's an editor who's getting anxious. So you're in trouble, basically. So there's failure. So you start with failure. This doesn't happen all the time, but it happens at the best of times, and it hurts. It's a horrible distress to realize your brilliant idea is silly and doesn't work. And so I sit there And inside I'm saying, why did I think I could be a cartoonist? Who, what a deluded, infantile fool I am. And doing this in public, demonstrating how pretentious and whatever, whatever. So, and I keep calm on the outside, of course, you know, being Anglo-Saxon sort of person. But inside it's all crumbling and it's collapsing, and I realise I've got to do something, I've got to find something. So, but what's happening at that point, what's happening at that point is my ego is crumbling. This, the ego, the simple ego we all have, which says, I am a cartoonist. That's sort of an ego. It's self-description we have of ourselves. You know, I am this, I am that. Nothing wrong, all perfectly natural, but that suddenly is gone, or it goes. And then that's the ideal. Suddenly I've arrived at the perfect place to find something and create something and see something, something I've never thought of before, in that state of lostness, being lost and in distress. But so you think, well, what have I got to lose? And the idea is you stay with the problem, stay with it, just stay and keep that pen moving, stop the mind moving and keep your pen, get the mind working with the pen, make a mess, spill some ink, play in it, make a mess, or as they say, make a mess and clean it up. So that's what's happening. And lo and behold, some little thought, some little idea take shape, and it's a start, and you're on the trail of it. You're on it. And then it's developing. So it's not an ascending into excellence, it's descending into kind of the primal raw state of our childhood self, possibly. Being lost, feeling failed, but not being frightened of it. Not being frightened. Have it and see it as a pathway to something you never thought of or felt before. That's how it can work. I think musicians know of this, composers, a lot of people know of this lostness.
Well, now, the Sunday Age asked you for a cartoon, but you gave them a prayer. Why?
Well, a cartoon seems so inevitable, and I've got some I've got a problem with what is inevitable. It's sort of, I'm always, if something's inevitable, oh, you should do that, and there is the road leading to that thing. I want to turn off and say, no, I don't want that. So it's just a funny compulsion to not go for the obvious, I suppose. So I thought a prayer, because my whole generation was so phobic about the idea of prayer. They were rational, clever, skeptical people, debunking of prayer. You know, this is God madness or something. Yeah. So that was the atmosphere I grew up in. And I was sort of, my father used the word God when he'd hit his thumb with a hammer or something like that. And my grandmother used the word, and they use it in the slang, if you like. And so I thought, what is this word? What is it refer to? J.S. Bach, Mozart, all use this word. They're not fools. So then prayer, what is that thing? Christopher Robin is saying his prayers, you know, you hear, yeah, you get all this sort of thing. What is this? This little talk to something, to something. And is it talking to self? Is God within, as, you know, the prophet in the gospel said? Is it something? I don't know what it is. I come to the view that it was a one-word poem eventually. When people say, what do you mean by God? I said, I don't know exactly, but it's there in our culture. And it's not up there. It's something, some genius within. I think every baby born has a sense of God but doesn't have a word for it. It's a sense of being alive and real and right and true, as the wonderful Donald Winnicott spoke about this. He was an English psychoanalytic kind of thinker and did a lot of work with mothers and babies. That's by the by. But, so I thought, oh, this is going to be a bit challenging for my friends, and indeed it was, and for the newspaper editors, you know, secular. Australia is pretty aggressively secular, or it can be at times. So I did it as a way of talking. When we get in despair, when we are lost, when we are alone, we talk to something sometimes within. We wake up at night with dreadful thoughts of sadness or whatever, and then it's not asking for something, it's just connecting to something. Yeah. Oh, what do we have?
Give us an example. This is a prayer of gratitude, I think.
Yes, this is simply this prayer was a way of addressing a little matters of life that are just pretty banal, perhaps, but maybe interesting. So this is a slightly funny one. We give thanks for the invention of the handle. Without it, there would be many things we couldn't hold on to. As for the things we can't hold on to anyway, let us gracefully accept their ungraspable nature and celebrate all things elusive, fleeting, and intangible. They mystify us and make us receptive to truth and beauty. We celebrate and give thanks. Amen.
Amen.
Amen. So, is that just a way of saying little philosophical things that are deeply personal?
Yes. And I mean, your approach to Christianity itself, or faith, or religion, or those things, that's again different, interesting. What do you think?
What do I think about Christianity? I grew up in a Christian culture. Not heavily Christian. My parents were pretty indifferent to the whole idea, and I was indifferent. But I sort of had a regard for it, in spite of all the religious instruction teachers who came into my school, men in white collars and things, and it wasn't very interesting. But the gospel story, what I took from it was this fella who we call Jesus, and he went around saying sort of some pretty wise and profound things and transgressing, basically. He crossed the line. He was inappropriate, you see, massively inappropriate, and he's punished for this. He's tortured to death, essentially. So I thought, wow, that's what might happen to anyone, more or less. I mean, you mightn't be tortured to death, but you might be tortured a bit if you say what you believe is true and you, just leave it at that, just as simply that, and you might pay a price. And I have found that to be true. I found that to be true. But there's a redemption in that death, you know, there's that suffering of that torture, I think, being persecuted by people. I mean, I'm greatly hated. I might be what you call living national treasure, whatever that means. I still
sounds
haven't
great.
Found out, and I don't care much, but there's a lot of hostility, a lifetime of hostility also, if you take a stand on, say, war, say the Iraq war. Say you're so disturbed and you start questioning this militarist impulse. Out it comes. It comes out of the woodwork. In times of war, there's a savagery comes out, and so hate mail comes in, and loads of hate mail come in. My hate mail was building up. I used to get it and read it, and then eventually you'd get to know this hate mail because of certain handwritings and things on the front. And I put it aside. And one day I was talking to a librarian from the State Library of Victoria, in Melbourne. And I said to her, I said, do you have a hate mail collection in your library? And she said, no. And I said, how would you like to start one? And she said, good idea. So I pass on my hate mail to the State Library of Victoria. And it's... And one day there'll be someone doing a PhD about hate mail, and there will be the collection.
There will.
Mm.
But do you have a court controversy? I mean, you are prepared to go into areas that are either unfashionable or difficult or, like I say, controversial, like questions about Israel and Palestine, about vaccination, for example, or, you know, childcare, those things... in a sense, are calculated to get people's dander up.
Well, they're not calculated. I'm just speaking from my heart, and I always find all the trouble I've ever been in takes me by surprise. I said, what's the problem? I'm just saying something that's quite reasonable. For instance, dare anyone go near the question of vaccination, but all I was saying in a cartoon was, look, let's not be too hard on mothers who have reservations. The mother's instinct is something our culture has revered. That there's some wisdom in a mother's intuition about how she holds her baby or raises her baby or protects her baby. This is a very sacred part of our culture. Mm-hmm. So I made a cartoon suggesting that, look, let's not just rush in and punish her. Let's not humiliate her and call her whatever. Well, you can't be that subtle. You get branded as what, an anti-vaxxer or something like this. I don't know what the heck that means, but... So you can't get rid of that. So you have to wear all these slanders about your thinking. So be it. Not nice.
Mm. One of the things that seems to be a thread in what you do is how wobbly the world is, how much of a mystery it is, how messy it is.
Mm.
Has that been your experience? Does it ever run true, or is it always messy?
I think it's messy, of course, and we spend a lot of time trying to make order of the chaos, and as you get older, things change and you become more vulnerable or more clear in some ways, even though old people are called, you know, muddle-headed. There's also a great clarity of what matters and what doesn't matter, etc. It's a mess in many ways. I mean, is the world not a mess at the moment in some ways? Are we all concerned about Brexit or the million and one things, and who knows the answer? And so on the surface, there's a semblance of order, respectability. Thank heavens that at least it's on the surface, but people are also anxious and lost sometimes, and relationships end catastrophically and things just fall apart. Not only, but that's a big part of life. Every psychotherapist can see that on a daily basis. And is the world, is the ecosystem, is nature out of balance? And are we, as part of nature, not also out of balance? Because that was my view, that just as Rachel Carson wrote a beautiful book in 1962 called The Silent Spring, which observed the use of pesticides in the American Northeast had put nature so radically out of balance that the birds were not singing, the birds had disappeared. And this was a very important principle to be established, this balance of nature and how fragile it is. And I think, well, we are nature. We're not part of nature. We are nature. And to what extent are we out of balance? And to what extent are we exposing ourselves to hurtful, damaging, sickening kind of practices? The need to have things is kind of crazy. To have experience, to have objects, to have just to have and have and have. And it's our normality, but when you think about it, it's kind of crazy. It's madness. And we end up with a mess. Our houses are full of stuff. And our minds are full of stuff. And our hearts are full of stuff. So to bring simplicity back and to slow down. And I had this idea that speed, the velocity of life, would frighten the hell out of our grandparents. It would scare them to death. So we're moving at such velocity, and as I've said, nothing can be loved at speed. You can't love well at speed, with momentum. And I think we suffer from the loss of love, not just for you and me, but for the creation and ourselves and all of life, and some sort of care of life, care of each other. I don't think we do it as well as we might, because we're so busy belting through life, having everything, and wondering why it's getting messier and messier. I mean, to wander around the UK in summertime is a bit scary. The tourists are everywhere, and I'm one of them. And so I'm not comfortable with it.
There's one of the things that you wrote, which has become a kind of little theme of your visit. Everybody's talking about FOMO. Fear of missing out.
Yes.
But you have another take on that, don't you?
Oh, FOMO. Yes, that's related. Nicola, you got that? Oh, thank you. Nicola's my wonderful assistant. She's my helper. This is not about FOMO, fear of missing out. It's JOMO, the joy of missing out. I'll read you this little poem, and it relates to what I've just been talking about. Oh, the joy of missing out. When the world begins to shout and rush towards that shining thing, the latest bit of mental bling, trying to have it, see it, do it, you simply know you won't go through it. The anxious, clamoring and need, this restless, hungry thing to feed. Instead, you feel the loveliness, the pleasure of your emptiness. You spurn the treasure on the shelf in favor of your peaceful self. Without regret, without a doubt. Oh, the joy of missing out.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, we've been very greedy because we've been saving up all these questions all these years, but now it's your turn for a while. There's a microphone here, if I can get this.
Yeah, if you'd like to put your hand up and we'll come and find you with our microphones. There's Lucy and me here. There.
Can you say something about the duck? More about the duck.
Oh, the duck. Yes. Well, there's much to be said about the duck, and sometimes not very much. There's that beautiful old poem, "From the Troubles of This World, I Turn to Ducks." Some of you might know that. Well, I had the ducks as a child, like a lot of people did. But the duck, I guess it's a nature symbol. It's a kind of harmless, it's benign. Does anyone here have any problem with ducks or doesn't like them? People like them, and they have a rounded beak. It's not a pointy, striking beak. It's just a dabbling beak. I like dabbling. We all like dabbling, I think. So it's a beautiful creature, and, you know, it can get a bit snappy. They get a bit snappy with each other, but nothing too serious I've ever seen. But I'd been drawing ducks. See, I first put a duck in a cartoon, which was a newspaper editorial, political cartoon. And I didn't really know why I did it. And I was said, "Why did you do that?" And I said, "Because I think the paper needs a duck in it." And it was, I was utterly genuine. I was sort of naive, if you like. And it's true. You know, we look at these politicians and the big issues, which we must do, but where is the little duck and all that it represents, you know, this, and the teapot. I put teapots in too. And I don't, there's probably not many people have problems with teapots, but, so you wanted these familiar, benign elements to balance the whole, the dreadfulness of the political world or whatever. And in due course, as often happens, a woman sent me an essay by a contemporary of Carl Jung, a psychoanalytic thinker called Marie-Louise von Franz, and the essay was titled The Significance of the Duck, the Archetypal Significance of the Duck in German Mythology. And it was a long essay, and it was really interesting. And it turns out the duck is a common sort of symbolic presence, as happens in the Hansel and Gretel story, where they're captured by the wicked witch, they escape, they try to get home, they come to a lake or a river, they can't get across, and a duck turns up and carries them across. And so it is that the duck is a symbol of transcendence. When we're blocked and can go no further, a duck turns up. Maybe some, just a metaphor, something like a duck turns up in our life when we're blocked. And it's funny, I'd been drawing the duck as a direction-finding duck, I called it. You know, when you're lost, follow the duck. So you're in a duck, maybe.
I knew you'd get a reference to cricket in there somewhere, Michael, talking about ducks, but there's another question over here.
Where are you? Oh, yes, me? Yes.
Hello. First of all, an invitation, Michael. At 11 o'clock, we'll be drawing in the make and take tent. Please come in, join us to prove that you are indeed a fine drawer. Second thing is, how long have you three been planning your hair? And the third point, what happens to you kind of, because you've talked a lot about some deep stuff for you personally, what happens when you don't draw, you know, because of circumstances, illness or whatever, and what does that do to you kind of physically and emotionally if you're unable to make things?
To draw, yes. Well, I love to paint as well. I like to draw and I like to write. It's, we all do. I like to cook. I like to make a garden. They're all the same thing in a way. And I think, if I may just quickly say, when I was a child, like many children and like probably many of you, we used to make what we called fairy gardens in the garden. We'd make a little fairy garden with little flowers and stones and twigs. And we'd spend a lot of time very devoutly making this thing in the great belief that this was going to be of some use to the fairies late at night when we were asleep. And so we'd put a lot into it. Next morning, get up, and sure enough, we'd see that the fairies had been. There was lots of evidence, you know, little footprints for the fairies. Well, and I've later thought, what a wonderful metaphor that is for making an artwork in later life. What a beautiful metaphor. It's exactly the same spirit you would enter into making a painting as you would have when you were a child. And so I call this mature innocence. Where the child does it in innocence, the adult can do it with mature innocence. We needn't abandon our innocence. In fact, to connect to it is not naive, it's our genius. And to speak from that position and act from that position and create from this idea of innocence, we can still be clever and sort of complex people, but we can still have our innocence. So that's a long-winded answer. Thank you.
There's a question over here. Thank you. Like, I really love your poem, The Awfulizers. It's one of my favorite. And I wonder if you could say a bit more about the forces of awfulization that you see around you.
Thank you. Yes, I think I remember that poem. It starts with, every night and every day, the awfulizers work away, awfulizing public places, tiny things and little graces. I forget where it goes, but yes, it, sometimes it seems you know, you look at your town and your the world around you, and there's some days when it seems, why are they doing this? Why are they building this city into a kind of a hellhole? Slow it down. So, you know, on a bad day, you can think like that. And probably on a very sane day, you can think like that. But it was, you know, the developers were running amok in Melbourne at one stage, and now they're just beyond amok. So, yeah, just addressing this. So the cartoonist has got to be a voice of the people who have no voice, the people who anguish, but there's no voice for their anguish, or grieve, and there's no voice for their grief, to express the unexpressed grief, etc. I mean, that might sound pompous, but it sort of is very simple. And you know, I'm not speaking for all the attractive, fashionable people. I'm speaking for the unattractive people, the neglected people, not because I'm virtuous, but they're often really interesting and intelligent sort of people. But there's those who have a voice and those who feel they have no voice. So that's what an artist can do. Yes.
Oh, well, firstly, thank you for your work. It's been really precious to me. And secondly, Solomon would like to know, who is your favourite cartoonist apart from yourself?
Who is my favourite cartoonist? Look, they're all wonderful, sort of. You know, some days I think, oh, this is so good. I wish I could do that cartoon. I don't really have a favourite cartoonist. I've got a keen eye for cartoons, and I saw lots of the Private Eye cartoonists when I was like, I used to love all that. So it's too much. And as people sometimes say, who are your great influences? I say, well, my school friends were.
I think it's... Oh.
Yeah, everything.
Hello. Big fan. It's really nice to see you in person. I wanted to ask you about something. On the back of one of my treasured books of yours, it has Barry Humphries saying, the wonderful thing about your cartoons is they're not political in a kind of shallowly political way. And I wanted to ask you about the personal and the political, because more and more people seem to be joining camps and lobbing things at the other side. And I wondered what you thought the relationship was between our personal evils, our personal foibles, and the foibles of the world outside, and where we situate in that.
Yes, that's a really big subject, I think. You know, the people lobbying. I find the current conflict in maybe what they call identity politics, that distresses me a bit. It's very tribal, and it's kind of a lot of punishment going on and seeking culprits and calling them out and all this. Yes, of course, you know, but it's, I find it distressing, the extent of it. And there's something about cooperation and forgiveness of each other that is very vital. So I don't know whether that's addressing something what you're talking about. And this terrible them and us, that unintegrated state of mind, we are right and they are wrong. We are good, they are bad. And there's a lot of that breaking out in popular culture, I feel. And it's also virtuous and proper and angry. There's a lot of anger, a lot of hurt and humiliation. I don't like it. It worries me because I can't see where it's heading. I think it's a universal, it's a psychic infection, I think, psychological infection.
Yeah, thank you. I was really struck by what you were saying about the children who'd drawn pictures from the Vietnam War and that sort of thing. I do work in various areas. I've gone into Bosnia and seen some of the childhood museum there and some of the drawings that children have done, and also working with refugees here and, you know, the real trauma that children are still undergoing. Mm. And I was just wondering if you had any response to what's going on in Australia with attitudes to refugees and how we can provide a better welcome.
That's a big question. I have no formula. I you know, I come back to simplistic things. Each day you do your best, you do what you can. I guess there are some people better suited to being in organizations than others, and I suppose that somehow we care and live according to the way we care. It's a slow process, I think. I don't think there's any magic formulas, basically. Sometimes there is, but how you find those, I don't know.
More ducks.
Yeah, I think we've got to care for each other more, that's all.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.